Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener. Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network.
Do you like wrestling trivia? Then check out the 5-Star Match Game, the Pro Wrestling Quiz Show. I'm Joe Gagne, and every episode, I grill three contestants with 5 rounds of power-packed wrestling trivia. We have over 30 evergreen episodes in the archives covering WWE, AEW, Japan, Mexico, and much, 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 much more. Play along at home and check it out today.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network. Visit VoicesOfWrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, over the rainbow, gotta let it go. So far, rain is a gun. Fast to freedom,
stars to light.
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate for September 2nd, 2025. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on that Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us on social media at Open Voice Gate. And if you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red box that says sponsor this podcast and you set up a one-time or reoccurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, joined alongside your other host, Case Lowe. In case, I got home today to get a wonderful package on my doorstep of that I've been privately like fretting about for like the last few weeks because of all the insanity that's happening with like the mailing things into the United States and the de minimis exemption going away. But Case, I am the proud owner of, I would say, about 5 pounds of Shoe Pros and Weekly Gonks, including the last issue of Weekly Gong from 2007. And when I was flipping through it after getting them all out and checking to see what they have, do you know what the other most celebrated thing in the final issue of Weekly Gong was, other than the ending of that magazine?
So 2007?
Correct.
Is it a wrestling-related thing?
Yes, it is.
Okay, I don't know what month. Let me try to do the Zach Galifianakis
hangover.
I'll
give you the
March of 2007.
March 28th, 2007 was the last issue of Weekly Gong.
Okay, so let me think about this. I'll give the listeners a chance to think about this as well. I'll talk out loud. So
yeah, I could fill some time for you.
No. I'm gonna think out loud. I don't need you to fill time. Okay. I'm gonna think out loud. So
yeah.
So let me put myself in the brain of 2007 for a second. So Tanahashi Nagata was April 13th, 2007. So that can't be it. The Do Fixer Muscle Outlaws Typhoon 3-way match was 6/5/07. So it can't be that. what was happening in NOAA February of 07? Probably nothing good. Because Kenta Marufuji is October 06. I feel like they probably had the belt off of Marufuji by then. But I don't know if it would be anything there. 2007 All Japan, you could tell me literally anything was happening and I would believe you. So it could very easily be a Kendo Kashin career retrospective. I don't think that's it, but I'm just trying to think about what Weekly Gong might have been doing in March of 2007. I'm gonna go with a morbid pick. I don't say this to be a punchline. I'm not trying to laugh at the situation, but it is something that I think would be quite funny if this was the answer. Is it a glowing tribute to the career of Chris Benoit?
Well, it is a bit of a retrospective towards the end of the back cover. So almost the entire magazine seems to be like retrospectives, and they got Inoki in on it. But the big back section is actually the retirement of Suwa from 2007.
Oh, our friend, yeah. Suwa.
Yeah. 2,100 people there on March 11th. Both Shima and Ultimo Tokyo were together in the same ring in 2007.
Ultimo Tokyo or Magnum Tokyo or Ultimo Dragon?
Ultimo Dragon.
Ultimo Dragon. Oh, okay. Wow. Oh, wow. I did not know that. Okay.
But yeah, no, they did a final like a Crazy Max reunion with like them. And then later on the show, then Suwa gets retirement. Ultimo's there. But yeah, no, it's an interesting issue just like flipping through it. Like that's the one thing that I'll say as someone who's just now really getting deep into kind of collecting these things is there's a predilection in both Shoe Pros and Gongs that like you like the glossy color section, and then like the next page will all be newsprint for like 16 pages. Mm. And I find that fascinating. The advertising is almost as shady as the 1960s and 70s wrestling magazines. I ended up with a big thing that I'm seeing that's getting advertised in 94 because I got a lot of those around J Cup is male body waxing for 120,000 yen.
Have you seen the HBO hit series Girls?
Yeah, I am a midterm millennial, so yes, I did. I grew up and remembering nearly everything about Girls and how everything kind of overwhelmed like blog culture for about two years.
Yeah. So I'm a firm believer, and I'm somebody, we were talking about how I haven't seen a lot of movies last week, but I have seen a lot of TV, and I say it with my chest that I think Shoshana Shapiro is one of the great characters in television history. And there is a storyline when she spends that season in Japan where she does some male waxing, and this is not a horny show, this will never be a horny show, but wow, did that unlock a world of possibilities that I was previously unaware of, specifically Zosia Mamet being involved. But that was formative. Do with that what you will.
You know what other issue of Weekly Gong Shoe Pro I got? I got February 28th. I'm sorry, not February 28th. February 22nd, 1994. That's right. Sasuke says, I didn't come to Tokyo to be swindled.
Ah, yes. No, he did not. But that worked out for him quite nicely. Do you want to talk real quick about the reunion that Magnum Tokyo and Milano Collection AT had this weekend?
My God, you had those two along with Shima, along with Masato Yoshino, and then Naoki Tanizaki. Like it's almost as if like the Rogues Gallery has assembled right there.
Yeah, that's a dangerous collection of mentally unwell men, all in their own, like they're all insane in their own separate way.
And Milano, we used to think it was just insane because he does his like chiropractic using his feet. Like that was the insane thing about that. Yeah, no, I wonder like how much like soul searching both him and Magnum Tokyo had to do to be like in the same room at the same time.
Well, what's funny to me is that when Suwa resurfaced a few years ago, it was this celebrated thing. Now, part of that was also that he was going to Dragon Gate shows. And I think some of the people that you and I talked to were like, oh, my God, like we're like hanging out with Sua. This is so much fun. This is so great. But Sua returned and he looked healthy and he had this big smile on his face whenever you saw him. And I've shared before that I had some brief interactions with Sua in an attempt to get an interview with him. And it was always very cordial and very pleasant. And it was just like, God, how great is this that, you know, we thought Sua, you know, might be on death's doorstep and then he resurfaced. And I know he's had health problems since, but like, man, this is just such a nice story. And whenever I see Magnum pop up on Shima's Twitter feed, I still see the same egomaniac that existed 20 years ago. I don't feel like any soul searching has been done. And I don't look at the face of Magnum Tokyo in 2025 and go, I bet he's changed. I go, no, I think that's the same guy.
Yeah, no. The only difference is now he's not going to wrestle because he is actually like the right kind of psychopath to go like, no one, I want to leave those memories in 1999. I don't want anyone to see what my body looks like in 2025, which I think is very relatable.
Yeah. I think that's entirely fair. But I like the dichotomy of those two resurfacings. And of course, they have not been seen together being Magnum and Sua. I don't ever anticipate that unless something horrible has happened. But nevertheless, yeah, I don't see Magnum Tokyo soul searching. I'm not getting that vibe from those photos.
Yeah. Like, I wonder what he's actually up to now, because for like a while when he went dark after Hustle, it's like, oh no, he's like leading all these karate dojos. And then I saw like a random photo of him pop up and he looked basically how he looked like now, but it was very clear. It's like, oh yeah, no, there's a reason he's not going to be wrestling anymore. And I don't know, like he's such like a enigmatic figure in the greater Dragon system. Like the fact that I mean, he's only like really started making appearances because of Kirishio Tokyo, Japan, of all people. That's the thing that I'm just going like, how is this happening now in 2025? Like Silver Magnum Tokyo is just popping up and is popping up around people that I've known. And it has been very public that have had nothing good to say about him for the greater part of what, 20 years or so.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I forget, did he publicly do the dance at a Glate show?
I don't think he did it at the Glate show. He was there at one.
But did he do the dance at like a produce show? Or I forget if it was
Kirishio Tokyo, Japan's produce show.
Okay, yeah, and then that's just like that. I don't know. That was like a thing for a day.
Yeah,
and then it just he just went back to Big Magnum. I thought that was so interesting. That's a guy where, you know, we're talking now when it's been almost 20 years since he retired as like a legitimate wrestler. And when you think about the continuously changing ecosystem in Japan, that's a hard legacy. It would be a hard legacy to untangle without 20 years in the wilderness. But yeah, that's just a guy that I think about a lot. And we've talked to Jay about him before, about just like, how do we, reckon's not the right word, because that makes it seem like Magnum was a part of something far more nefarious than he was, but just
how do we contextualize
this career? A guy that for a 6-year period was kind of crucial to the Japanese ecosystem and then just went away.
I feel like that there were so many cases of like Magnum like figures, if you really want to think about it. I mean, what is really kind of the difference between Magnum Tokyo and Super Delphin right now? Super Delphin does like his stuff around Osaka, but he is basically like not even like close, even like the Okinawa Pro days of it. Like he's showing up and doing things whenever people come in town or there's like an Osaka Pro show, or whenever he wants to get Flying Penguin on a show out of like his 2-5 wrestling project. But he's basically, you know, a non-entity in like a same kind of way. But we're talking about someone that maybe for Delphin, we're talking about like 93 to, I'm trying to think when he split from Osaka to do Okinawa. It was like 2010, maybe.
Yeah.
But that was also Osaka Pro that went through so many different things that it was not very much seen as the promotion that Delphin formed after he got ticked off for the last time with Sasuke, right? So I feel like there's a lot of those kind of figures. And
but the Delphin thing, sorry to cut you off there, but you know, the Delphin thing is an interesting comp because I largely agree with it, but I can sit someone down as we've done with those days, which by the way is not going anywhere. I apologize. My scheduling's been a mess. Those days is not forgotten about. It's not on the back burner. They're coming. I'm sorry. I'm deeply, deeply sorry. But you know, when we watch those days, every episode, you and I, it's like we're from, you know, across the country the way that we are. It's like we're nudging each other on the shoulder going like, hey, you know who's pretty good? The Super Delphin guy. Delphin, I think, in terms of the bubble that we operate in, the people that listen to the show, it's so much easier to explain, hey, this is Super Delphin, here's why he's important, to Magnum. And maybe I'm wrong on that, but it's just, you know, I can show people a dozen Delphin matches where I'm like, yeah, he's sort of whipped ass in this match. Like, look at how incredible he is. And with Magnum, you know, you see the entrance and then you have to be really careful with what you show people because some of it's going to be really, really bad.
Yeah. And I feel like also in the greater scheme of things, and if we really want to kind of get metatextual about the Dragon System, there are so many, like we talk about fan turnover a lot, and it's something where I would love to know, like, and the data will never be there, but I would love to see, like, what is the average lifespan of a Dragon Gate fan, where Dragon Gate is like they go to, if they're in Tokyo, they go to every Korkin show, and then when eventually they kind of deprioritize it. I feel like that'd be very interesting. But like when we try to contextualize Magnum, you get the whole issue of, okay, he makes it through all of Toriumon and he is the guy, like day one, January 31st, 1999, and things never are necessarily as big for him or he feels as capital I important as he does on that Enter the Dragon show, right? Like everything after that, there are some amazing performances, and especially it's not like that this guy is a lout in the way that I feel like Takashi Yoshida sometimes gets contextualized as. He just is someone that, I mean, Shima just laps him so quickly, and then Dragon Kid comes online in 2000, and Mochizuki, then it becomes like this whole other element, and then what are you kind of left with Magnum, who in 2001 is still kind of just being Magnum, so you have to turn him heel and then do the whole M2K thing. But by the time he's out of the company, really, in 2006, I think that's more of a thing of, that's essentially the end of the, if we want to like look at this like in a civilization-based kind of way, like it is like talking about, okay, the Roman Empire crisis of the third century, and you're also talking about, and you're like in a modern history class, like it's prehistoric essentially because of all the turnovers and all of the kind of changes. It just makes the discussion in a lot of ways like, oh, this is this person who was immediately important. He still remained important, left in kind of a way that I don't feel like we're ever going to get the full true answer of. And then 20 years passes and he just starts popping up and other people who are not in the main Dragon System promotion and around it. And it's just like, how are we supposed to assess this case? Like, this is essentially like moon landings happening. It, at least as it relates into like the Dragon System kind of way.
It also, it doesn't help that Magnum is feigning in relevance as Dragon Gate makes their way into America. And I truly, truly don't know and would have loved to have seen, minus possible homophobic slurs that could have been thrown his way, I would have loved to have seen just for one night what Magnum and Gabe's Ring of Honor would have looked like. And I think that
2006 possibly, Magnum, man.
Well, 2005. You know, if like that show that Shima and Shingo are on.
Okay, yeah, the Magnum's Buffalo show.
Also,
yeah,
if Magnum's also on that show, I mean, we see how that works with, I would say, pre AEW, every Japanese wrestler that came to the States, they loom larger than the ones that never did. It's the difference between you know, Mara Fuji and Jun Akiyama in the way that some people remember them, because Mara Fuji was around, Jun Akiyama was not. But yeah, if Magnum was on that Buffalo show, I think that would have been really interesting to see. And I don't know if that would have been a good or a bad thing. I don't know who he would have wrestled. I don't know what that would have looked like, but it's a shame that we don't have that alternate dimension to enter into.
But I think this, it's kind of interesting that we end up talking about Magnum Tokyo, because at least for the remainder of this edition of The Voice Gate, we're kind of treating this episode about there was the homecoming show for Naruki Doi celebrating his 25th anniversary in Nara on the 30th on Sunday, but we're just kind of just wanting to talk about Naruki Doi. And in some ways, I feel like a analog, or maybe like if you're putting people into groups throughout Dragon System history, I feel like Madame Tokyo and Naruki Doi end up in the same group. Is my logic kind of wrong there? But I feel like there's a lot, at least personality and presentation wise, the two of them are kind of kindred spirits in one way.
I'm not sure I fully understand.
Maybe it's like attitude of promos.
Okay.
And like self-ego. I mean, Mr. Ikatis with Naruki Doi, who turns on Masato Yoshino in the first place because World 1 in his mind was supposed to be all about him.
Yeah, okay. I think that's fair. You know, there are two people that you certainly can't write the history of this promotion without, and that's sort of what I started to think about this weekend as we did Doi's 25th anniversary in his hometown and had the great Nara homecoming show, or I should say a very good homecoming show, but I just started thinking about Doi over the weekend and just the way that I think even in the time that you and I have known each other, and even in the time that you and I have done audio together, whether it be, you know, at times monthly or for the last 5 years weekly, I just think Doi's legacy has changed perhaps more than any veteran wrestler on the roster in the time that we've been doing this show. Like, I think we began, you know, when we would have met, I think we both thought of Doi in one very specific context, and now the way that we look at him is completely different. And that is very interesting to me. And then you factor in, you know, what is really, I think, a historically underrated career. And I didn't prepare for this with a massive timeline. I didn't tell you to prepare for this with a giant timeline. I just kind of want to kick the soccer ball around with Naruki Doi, you know, have a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects when it comes to Doi, just because I think his career is so interesting. And I'll start here, which is that 4 years ago, you and Alan Forel and I were doing the Greatest Wrestler Ever project, a five-year update on the 2016 Pro Wrestling Only ballot. You can find all of that audio on Alan's Pro Wrestling Torch feed. I still get DMs from people that go back and listen to those shows and say they really enjoyed them. So that means a lot. That's really nice to hear. But one of the names that was on my bubble for that entire time was Naruki Doi. And he was not somebody that I considered in 2016. I actually found him to be one of the easier Dragon Gate legacy cuts. And then 2021 came around and we were coming off of his Open the Dream Gate run. And I think, in terms of just submitting a list of wrestlers, I felt a little bit more self-assured than maybe I did in 2016, and I was a little bit more comfortable, I don't want to say puffing my chest out, but being like, no, Dragon Kid is one of the 100 greatest wrestlers of all time. Masaaki Mochizuki is one of the 10 greatest wrestlers of all time, et cetera, et cetera. And I found myself, as we got closer and closer to our self-imposed deadline, just thinking a lot about Doi. And when I finally made the decision that Doi was in the top 100, he very quickly shifted from the 95 to 100 range to the 95 to 90 range. And then I think I had him at 81 by the time things were all said and done. And I just realized once I committed to this idea, and I do think you have to commit to it to some degree, that Naruki Doi is one of the 100 greatest wrestlers of all time, you realize just how great Naruki Doi is. And I think even to some people that know that name and might have seen a large body of his work, that might be shocking, but as time goes on, I continue to think that highly of Doi and his body of work.
Yeah, I've had him, just for the sake of the record, I had him at 44 in 2021. And a lot of that, like, quick moving was something that I feel like is kind of one of the, at least between the two of us and some others, I can say the there are stark differences of opinion of Naruki Doi as a tag wrestler versus a singles wrestler, and a big hinge point about Naruki Doi, I feel like, started at the end of 2019 going to 2020 with that second Dreamgate run that kind of changed the conversation about him as a singles wrestler, I feel like. And it's something where I feel in 2025, I don't think I'm going to probably, unless Alan goes, we need to go do, we need to get the gang back together. We have to do one last 4-hour show as a 5-year update. I don't know how much GWE stuff I'm really in a position to do.
Let me tell you, the only content I can commit to for that is if people would like to do a Mystico episode and a What I've Learned About Lucha Since 2021 episode, I'd be more than happy to oblige them. Otherwise, I think I'm more of a 2031 kind of guy. I think that's kind of where I can land on GWE right now. Let me tell you, I really have a desire to do these Michinoku Pro podcasts, and I can't find the time to do them. I don't have a desire to do a Greatest Wrestler Ever project right now. So it's looking like a 2031 project for me, not a 2026 project.
No, I totally get you with that. And as I look at Super Dolphin and True Pro on my desk, I go more like, yeah, no, I kind of wanted to do more of the Michinoku thing.
They're coming. So I'm sorry to everybody. I'm sorry to Mike. I'm stressed out about it because I never start projects I don't finish. It's driving me nuts that we haven't been able to do more of them, but we're doing them. I promise. Joe Vimmer, to remember, hasn't had an episode in a year. God bless you, Joe, but we're going to be on a better pace than that. I'm all stressed out, Mike. You don't know how stressed out I am about it. I feel so bad that we didn't do one in August, but we didn't do one in August.
But we're not going to stress about that. That was August. It's September now, bud.
And my September calendar not looking much better. October, let me tell you, October, there are open dates in that calendar. November, December, hey, Christmas, we're watching Michinoku Pro this year. Christmas morning, ignore your family. I'm sure it'll be a 90. We'll be watching Garouken Mask League at that point. It'll be a good time, but... Good lord. Fukuman Mask. Like, Garouken Mask is just a wrestler. I would like to watch him too.
I mean, he ties in the overall Michinoku Pro thing. I mean, he's a former Mel Mongoose. Come on.
Yeah, he's part of the lineage.
Yeah, he's part of the family. But I do really feel like that Naruki Doi as a tag team wrestler, if we were going to use like the 5-year kind of boundaries here, he has added to his legacy, but I don't think he has changed many opinions other than, hey, Doiyoshi wasn't just like a pairing of two guys who were just great together. Now we have further evidence with like his teams with Dragon Kid, and even, I mean, this falls within like previous like year blocks. I mean, at Doiyama, like this, like nothing really changes about talking about Naruki Doi as a tag team wrestler. I still, in 2021, I thought he was one of the 10 best tag team wrestlers of all time. And in 2025, on his 25th anniversary, not much has changed in that regard. But I feel like that in a lot of ways, he is someone that, one of the matches we're going to talk about tonight is one of his matches during his maiden Dreamgate run. And then we'll talk about one of the matches that he actually won the Dreamgate back in 2019, as well as the NARA homecoming show. But I feel like that going back and like revisiting some of the stuff in a time that he was very strongly maligned, and at least as someone who was following the product at that time, I was not kind of deviating that much from that sort of consensus other than some kind of matches. But maybe it is having the 2020 Dreamgate run kind of refreshing our palate towards him that makes me want to go back and see, like, maybe critically this title run is a lot better than I thought of the moment. Yes, there's other factors that didn't work out so great for him as champion that weren't necessarily the him in the ring necessarily. And I feel like that's like the one big thing that I feel like has changed about Naruki Doi, at least over the last 5 years, has been that singles wrestling reassessment.
Absolutely. You know, and it was always a thing with him where I think as you went through his Dragon Gate career specifically, you know, 2005 onwards, and I want to circle back to that in just a minute, but from 2005 on, it's not like he doesn't have great singles matches. He does, and a few of them are really high-end matches. A few of them are very obviously great in a way that to me felt undeniable. But even from the time that I started following Drangate and participating in some level of discourse, which would have been early 2014, it felt like there was just this cloud hanging over Doi that related back to that first Dreamgate run that you couldn't ignore. It was kind of like, this is Naruki Doi. He was in this tag team with Masato Yoshino. This is around the time that he starts teaming with Yamato. Oh, and by the way, he was a bad Open the Dreamgate champion. It was just like this other thing that was thrown in there that you sort of had to accept as just the reality of it all, that this was a part of his lineage. And I really do feel like it stayed with him through the end of 2019 when he kicked off that second Dreamgate run. But yeah, you know, I, as a tag team wrestler, I mean, I don't know. Is he the greatest tag team wrestler ever? I mean, I'll ask the question point blank.
I mean,
for somebody that's been in multiple successful tag teams. So we're taking the Bucks out of this. We're taking the Briscoes right out of this. You know, I'd probably take Gibson and Morton out of this conversation just because that, you know, they only had the, but in terms of being a versatile tag team wrestler, is there anybody that's done what Doi has done?
I mean, the classical response is Bobby Eaton, which is very similar to Naruki Doi's. I remember that. I think around a time like Alex Shelley like firing off a tweet about like calling Naruki Doi Japan's Bobby Eaton, and that I forget when that was, but that kind of always rung true in my head about him. But I think like that's one of the things. Terry Gordy, I feel like, would have to be up there when you're talking about guys with multiple tag team partners. Trying to think of, would you really count? I wouldn't count Inoki in on it. On it, even though he had like multiple big runs, especially with Sakaguchi.
Well, I mean, you can count him, but I don't think he's better than Doi.
Critically, no. I'm just going through tag team histories. Misawa, I don't think he was as good as a tag team worker as Doi. Kobashi maybe had a couple matches peak higher than Doi, but I think his overall career is not, at least if you're just relating it to tag team work, isn't necessarily there.
That's a great shout, because Kobashi, you've got the Misawa team, which Kikuchi. I don't feel like anybody, I mean, it's okay. Yeah. I should have said nobody talks about the Misawa tag team, but it's just when you talk about Kobashi, you're not like, hey, you know, he was in that really good tag team with Misawa too. But even though he has, I shouldn't say that, because he has two of the most famous tag team matches of all time. Then they get talked about plenty still. But yeah, Kikuchi, Misawa, Akiyama, Johnny Ace, and then in Noah, who does he win the GHC tag belts with?
Rikkyo, I thought.
Is it? No. I was thinking earlier. Hold on. Let me see if I can. There's a Kobashi Noah tag match that I'm thinking of. Oh, Honda. He has him with Honda for a minute. I like some of that stuff too. So Kobashi's an interesting one that off the top of my head I would not have thought of, but I kind of like the Kobashi answer too, which I think only reinforces the fact that he's literally the greatest to ever do it.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things that when you kind of like look at it, and especially under the guise of someone who has like multiple tag team partners and of that certain level, yeah, that I don't know why I thought it was Rikkyo. I was clearly thinking Tamon Honda. For some reason, I conflated those two.
Well,
in my mind.
When you boil it down, I don't know if there's a ton of difference between those two gentlemen. That's a fair mistake to make.
One of them was an actual GHC heavyweight champion.
Oh, and then there's the Shiozaki stuff too. You know, he's got a nice little run there with Shiozaki in the post GHC heavyweight title run.
Maybe Shiozaki should be someone considered.
Okay, so what? Let me.
No, I can't think. I was just thinking of people with multiple prominent tag team partners in the recent era, but Axis and that little bit of tag team work with Kobashi alone, I don't know if it makes it.
No, I wouldn't say so, but this did just make me realize that I really miss having Goshi Ozaki in my life, which I was not expecting to feel right now, but all of a sudden I have the urge to go watch old Goshi Ozaki. I don't know if anybody else is feeling that, but my God.
But like, like going away from just like Noah people, I can't necessarily think of like an American tag team worker other than Eaton. And when you think about that in like a multiple tag team kind of sense, yeah, you have like the Midnight Express pairings, but you don't really talk about Randy Rose outside of and Condrey outside of the Midnight Express, really.
Yeah.
Kern, maybe, but I don't think Kern. I think Fantastics was kind of like one thing, and he was always kind of chasing it after that.
I would agree with that. I would put Doi's body of work ahead of that.
Yeah, no, it really kind of becomes a Eaton or Doi conversation, if you ask me. Maybe I think Saban's a great tag team worker, but I don't think he's at that tier though.
Well, not to zag, but I think we're the Motor City Machine Gun stuff. It's like, well, they were good, but were they that good? I almost would rather take Shelly, because Shelly, you get Kushida and Jimmy Rave as tag team partners, and
yes,
Saban,
Shelly's better. So yes, Shelly is the third person up in the conversation. Then you sold me on that. I don't know how I forgot about Time Splitters.
And the Time Splitters thing, like, go look at the Time Splitters cage match at some point, and you're going to go, oh my god! And then you have to remember that in real time. And I thought this was stupid then. I think it's even stupider now. I've said this on the show before. In real time, we were getting monthly combinations of Beretta Rocky Romero or Rocky Romero Alex Kozlov versus the Bucks versus Red Dragon versus the Time Splitters. And people were complaining about it in real time. And I was like, why? It's a guaranteed 4-star match every time. It kicks off these New Japan shows that were historically great in the best way possible. You guys are really dumb for complaining about this. I felt that then, and I feel that way now. But I would have Shelly over Saban.
Romero? Romero has multiple partners.
But he's not, like, I love Rock, close personal friend Rocky Romero, but, like...
Sure.
But his body of work doesn't... I mean, it doesn't sniff Doi's. Again, I, honest to God, the name that you said that I was like, okay, you know what, that's fair competition, is Kenta Kobashi as a tag team wrestler.
I don't know. I mean, when you take some of the Havana Pitbulls, I feel like had some great work in the Ring of Honor.
I agree.
And then Forever Hooligans, both in New Japan and AAA, were highlights of those promotions.
I think the Hooligans New Japan run is underrated. I still, to this day, my favorite Young Bucks match in Japan is Super Junior Tag League 2013 Finals, the Bucks' first tour. This match isn't even on New Japan World. It's a Samurai TV airing. It was right before World launched, or I guess a year before World launched. And so this was when New Japan was still on Samurai partially. And it was Forever Hooligans versus the Bucks Cork and Hall main event. It's the best thing the Bucks ever did in Japan. And the Hooligans are a big part of that. Again, I love Rock. And not to cut you off, but then, you know, you get into the Beretta tag team from there. I think he's great. I don't think he's on the same stratosphere as Doi as a tag team wrestler.
I'm just trying to think of people with prominent multiple tag team partners and strong work with both the tag team partners with that. And yeah, the one that I'm kind of, the more I'm kind of thinking about it, that, man, he was, I wish we could re-roll his career, because I feel like it would have ended up a little better with this, as certain things broke different ways for him in this conversation. I'm not submitting him as a candidate here, but Chuck Taylor. I feel like Chuck Taylor is someone that, if things broke the right way, he might have been in this conversation, given the tag works he had with Gargano, with Beretta and others. He might have been someone there if things broke better for him in certain different ways.
Yeah, the Icarus tag team as well.
Yeah,
before the first Chikara hiatus. Yeah, Taylor's an interesting one, just because I do feel like we got the worst version of his career. When Gargano came into PWG, his first weekend he teamed with Chuck against the Bucks. And that was my introduction to Gargano. I loved it. He got booked on every PWG show until he got signed from there on out. Famously, big Young Bucks guy. And I find all of their work to have aged incredibly well. The thought of watching a Chuck Taylor, Johnny Gargano, Young Bucks match in 2025 is a little daunting. And I think that's way more about Gargano than it is Chuck Taylor. But there is an entire period of Taylor's career that I'm just not sure in 2025 eyes if I'd enjoy it in the same way that I once did.
Yeah, and he never got like the feature position in whenever he could have had that opportunity too. So when we even talk about Dragon Gate USA stuff, it's kind of like, oh yeah, no, he was the workhorse who could back up Gargano or Swan, but it was never going to be all about him. So you never really got to have the idea really throughout his entire career of him being like the focal point or like the captain of a team, unless you kind of, at least for some portions of Best Friend, I would argue that he was kind of the driving person. And then it was especially in the PWG era. And then Trent kind of on the back end.
I still think the most interesting thing he ever did was when Gabe brought him back and he was all caps Dustin. Yeah. And it was him and Galloway and EC3, which, you know, is a combination of guys that sounds like a nightmare on paper, especially because I'm never as high on Galloway as other people are. But
that also sounds like a demonic smoke circle between those three. Things yeah, can get real dark.
Nightmare blunt rotation. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, I always thought that was a really interesting thing that Gabe was trying to do. And I don't know the politics. I mean, Gabe and Chuck always had a weird relationship, but I don't know if this was those guys flaming out again. I don't really know what the story is behind that and why that was dropped. I don't know if it was maybe something to do with EC3 not holding up his end of the deal. I don't know. But, you know, that started as a hot angle at a time when Evolve really mattered and was acting as a launching pad for so many people. And it seemed like Chuck might have been ready to make that springboard, and then that angle just disappeared and we never really got to see the end of that. So that was a bummer.
Yeah, no, that's firmly cemented in my brain because of Flow Slam and the fact they kept on playing the vignette where all caps Dustin would say, you know, Drew Galloway is a really smart guy. You should listen to what he has to say.
That was the show. Again, this era of Evolve, I remember so well because I was watching everything. And I mean, I really, really liked this promotion at this time. So, yes, I found this easily. I wish I could care about the stock market in the same way that I care about 2016 Evolve. So this was Evolve 67. There was a Tony Nese Peter Casa match on this show that was a disaster. Casa, for as much as I liked him as a wrestler, and he would have just been coming off that Dragon Gate tour, he was not ready for this spot. It was a mess. That match was bad. This was also
really should have just stayed in Japan for another 18 months.
And should have worked exclusively six-man tags because that he was never a capable singles wrestler. He
was like the prototype for how Monte ended up as the case study of if you're here long enough, then eventually you can get good, if not great. If Peter Casa stayed in Dragon Gate for another 18 months, who's to say how good he could have been? And, you know, that could have kept him out of Gabe's shitty ring.
It would have kept him out of Gabe's shitty ring. And then there was that Evolve show at LaBoom where I don't remember who the Evolve tag team champions were. It might have been Dickinson and Jaka at that point. Shout out Jaka, I miss him. But they did Casa and Ricochet as a team against whoever the Evolve Tag Team Champions were. And that match was awesome because Casa, all he had to do was come in and do high spots, and Ricochet did the rest of the work, and it was great. But Nice versus Casa was a total disaster. It was around this time in the show when Danielson and Regal, and I think Claudio, funnily enough, the way that history has, you know, interwoven itself once again, it was SummerSlam weekend, so those guys walked in the building at that point. And then there was Matt Riddle versus Tom End, Cedric Alexander versus Zack Sabre Jr., and they had a few matches around that time, and they were all really, really good. Hero versus Cody, which I don't remember, but I know it was Cody and Evolve, so I know I didn't like it. And then, and again, this is 2016, this is peak Evolve. It's a rabid crowd. It's SummerSlam weekend. Danielson's in the building. There's like a real buzz to this show. And I bring all of this up to say that there was an Evolve title match on that show. And it was Thatcher versus Gulak at a time when the Thatcher stuff, it had long worn out its welcome. Like going into that match, it was like, why is Zack Sabre Jr. not champion? Why is Cedric Alexander not champion? Why is Matt Riddle not champion? Because this is the apex of Riddle's career. You know,
there was like Darby and Darby was starting to come around. This is right
when Darby came in. This is when Yeha and TJP were teaming, and I was super into that. The roster was incredible. You know, as we said during the Dragon Gate USA series that we did, you could always tell when Gabe is motivated and when he's not, and he was super motivated at this time. And then there's this Thatcher Gulak match that was so fucking bad, and it was so fucking long, and it was so boring, and it just like it killed the room immediately. They had the gift of the lead-in match being Hiro and Cody during Hiro's incredible year, and this must have been Cody's first Evolve appearance. If not, it was his second weekend there. But like that show again, if you remove, you know, Ethan Page and Kobe Durst and then Tony Nese, Peter Casa, Riddle, Tommen, Zack Sabre Jr., Cedric Alexander, Chris Hero, Cody Rhodes, and then you get this Thatcher Gulak match that to this day is stuck in my head as being of all the bad Timothy Thatcher matches that I've seen, and I've seen a lot of them, including in Las Vegas earlier this year. That Thatcher Gulak match is one of the worst things he's ever done, because it was why he sucks. It's why he's such a deeply flawed wrestler, because he couldn't have read that room worse. And he went in and did his thing and sat on the mat for 20 minutes, and that match was putrid.
And they still did a rematch after that.
Remember, well, that was when, like, they did the like ring survival thing where they wrestled on the boards. And that actually ended up being, that was, I mean, I was dreading that just based on the prior match, but I gotta say they kind of won me over with that gimmick.
Yeah. And then whenever you bring out the boards, it kind of works out. Did have enough interest to see what Jaka is up to. All he does is team in Boca Raton with Sean Maluda.
Ah, good for him.
His last match was a 3-on-2 handicap match. Johnny Fairplay and Odyssey defeat Jaka, Sean Maluda, and Neil the Heel. The special guest referee, Frank the Clown.
Wow, that is
awful.
That is the worst thing I've ever heard. That is uniquely bad. I don't know what to say to that. So let's go back to Naruki Doi real quick. Yeah. I'm gonna throw it to you for this. And again, I didn't tell you to prepare anything other than that we both watched an old Doi match that we'll review here in just a minute. But I find it funny that we're recording on the day that we are, because it's the 25th anniversary of Awashi's debut and Yoshino's debut. And who else? Milano?
Milano would have been this day too. Yeah.
And then there's one more. So let me figure it out, because there were four guys and now it's going to drive me nuts that I don't know. So it was Yoshino and Awashi, and let me pull up the 9-2 Toribon Mexico show. This was thought this was gonna be easier than it was, because Doi debuted in May.
Yeah, because Doi was brought up a little quick and then he got hurt.
Was it Oyanagi and Iwasa? Yes, it was. It was Oyanagi and Iwasa. Those were the other two guys that debuted on this day in history. But we're talking on this day, and I figured it'd be worth bringing this up because, you know, you talk about Yoshino's career, let's say, which we've done at length, and you reference a lot of Toriumon stuff. You reference the Super Shisa match in Toriumon. You reference the Darkness Dragon Kness feud and some of the stuff they did with Dragon Kid very early on, and then the interplay between he and Milano. And you talk about Milano, obviously, you know, deeply entrenched in the history of Toriumon. Naruki Doi's career, he debuts in 2000, but for all intents and purposes, he really debuts in 2005. And we did that episode in January of this year where we broke down the January 2005 Corken Hall show and why it's one of the most important shows in the history of the company. But Mike, can you, to the best of your ability, sort of explain what Naruki Doi was doing from 2000 to December 2004?
Yeah, I'm going to try to do this mostly by memory, but I do have some notes pulled up just in case if things happen. So he debuts in 2000, and immediately he's put into a gimmick called Second Doi because of the former Yomomeri Tokyo Giants player, Shoujo Doi, and then they kind of made him stick to this gimmick throughout throughout Toriumon and into throughout T2P and then into 2004, and then he basically gets adopted into Final M2K as kind of as their new sort of up and comer, and then we talked in depth about his turn in January of 2005, but he was not anywhere close to a top line player throughout his early career. Like, he has won a UWA trio championship with with Arkin and Dragon Kid towards the almost the like the exact end of M2K, and they have one defense and drop it to CTU. So not even really, like, he's not getting pushed essentially until the dying days before the split happens, before Dragon Gate launches and Ultimo is kind of left picking up the pieces. He is not even considered a figure that really is a player up until that Shin M2K run.
When I think about his time in Toriumon, I only have two matches that really come to mind. One of them being Genki and Susumu versus Doi and Iwasa from Absolute Mente 2002, which is a show that I'm sure most everybody has seen. It's the Crazy Max Italian Connection show, Darkness Dragon, Dragon Kid Mask versus Mask match as well. But I always thought what they did in that opening match was just a rare good Toriumon showcase for Doi. And then you have to jump all the way ahead to the final Toriumon show, Arakan, Mochi, Doi, and Susumu versus Shogo Takagi, Takuya Sugawara, Toru Washi, and Yashi in an 8-man tag on that Anniversario show, which isn't, you know, a killer match by any means, but the options with Doi and Toriumon are very, very slim. And so those are the only two that come to mind. Again, it's like, for all intents and purposes, this guy's career begins in January of 2005.
And we talked about that last year during the 25th anniversary of the Toriumon Japan landing and the 25th anniversary celebrations for Dragon Gate. We talked about how he essentially turns and forms Blood Generation with Shima, Don Fuji, and Masato Yoshino, and then the Open the Brave Gate tournament becomes the he becomes the inaugural Open the Brave Gate champion, and he's already treated off to the races as kind of the up and comer within this unit. And then basically up until the end of, I would say, maximum, he is one of the bigger frontline players in this promotion. But the first 5 years, you're not going to be finding much. It really is January of 2005.
Final question before I get into these match reviews, and then at the very end we'll kind of run through this Nara show because I think there's a few things worth mentioning. But is what if you were stuck with Doi in one unit, you know, and you only had access to that footage for the rest of time, what era of Doi's career are you picking?
Man, that is a difficult question.
I feel it is actually of all the legacy members on the roster, mm-hmm. Doi is possibly the toughest, which goes to not only his longevity, and I really should start putting Doi in that conversation. When I mentioned Susumu, when I mentioned Mochizuki, and, you know, for a while, you know, when Yoshino was winding down his career, I'd always mention, like, hey, these guys have been wrestling 20 years. That's 1979 to 1999. Think about that and contextualize it and think if anybody was good for that duration. I especially lean on that with Susumu. And now Doi at 25 years and still going as strongly as he is, I think, I for some reason, I don't know if it's just because he's ageless, but we leave Doi out of the longevity conversation, and we shouldn't. But, you know, between Blood Generation and Muscle Outlaws and World One and World One International and Blood Warriors and Mad Blanky and then Maximum
Berserk.
And then Berserk, and, you know, and then, you know, Toriumon Generation, which I think would be a crazy answer, but it would make me laugh if you said that. You know,
what if I said Team Boku?
Well, I know you well enough to where I'd be like, well, I guess I see where he's coming from. it would be the definition of I'm not mad, I'm disappointed. So, but
yeah,
You know, there's 15 solid years there from Blood Generation, I would say, through Toriumon Generation, where he's just locked in with whatever unit he's in.
Yeah, and I think he is not a Mount Rushmore person that in the promotion and in the lineage, that's not kind of what we're saying about this. But when you think about Doi, he is someone that has been there for all of like the major landings as soon as he showed up. I feel like that with that and the fact that he got two real runs with the belt. I know we say he was kind of screwed with COVID and all of that, but it's something where like after the Mount Rushmore, he is probably like the example of the person that is the gatekeeper to the Mount Rushmore in a lot of ways, just because he is, I would say, within Dragon Gate, he is the second most decorated member of the Big Six remaining. I think that after Yamato, if you're looking at longevity, really, it's Doi after that. I mean, you take Shingo and Tozawa off the plate naturally when you have that kind of discussion. He's just someone that I think that, and especially when you get to see Doi outside of the Dragon system, and when he does his appearances, like, in Dragon Gate USA, when there was the time where he was just basically kind of doing touring championship matches, and he would have some real interesting contests against the likes of John Moxley or Sami Callihan, and you contrast that with, hey, he is the guy, a part of like one of the most, and I know Garrett could tell us exactly, one of the most shared TNA things of all time in the Speed Muscle and Motor City's Machine Gun Impact stint in 2007. So he might not be one of the first names that come to mind when we think about the Dragon system and we think about who is on that Mount Rushmore, but it's not that he falls short. He just kind of, in his way, he is the best at what he did. And he still really is able to still have that longevity kind of case, because I would argue that him going freelance in a lot of ways has strung out the return of his or the final few years of his career. Because remember, in 2022, when he went freelance, the big idea was, hey, he's wrestling the places he wants to wrestle as much as possible until he kind of closes up shop. But we're now looking at the end of 2025, almost three full years after him going freelance, and now he's hosting this really exciting looking self-produce show in Shinkiba on November 7th, and maybe we'll be back here in 5 years talking about his 30th anniversary, when 3 years ago that didn't seem like that was going to be the case.
It's been a great run. You know, I never would have expected to enjoy this era of Doi's career as much as I have. I found the freelance stuff at the time, and part of that you have to contextualize as to when it was happening and the state of Dragon Gate and some of the exits that they had had at that point. You know, I found him announcing that he was going freelance to be a little depressing, and I just assumed at that point that we were done seeing Doi in any real meaningful way in Dragon Gate. And you know, the greatness now is a little bit fewer and further between than it had been, but the guy still has it, and the guy still has his charisma, and he still has those intangibles that make him such a special wrestler. And I'm just very glad that we're here with 25 years of Naruki Doi.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the two matches we kind of picked from his catalog to celebrate this anniversary. We both kind of independently chose Dreamgate matches. I chose one from 2009. You chose one from 2019, both two completely different eras of Naruki Doi's career, and especially where he is and how things kind of ended up with at least at the time what I thought was his best match of the 2009 through 2010 Dreamgate run against Koji Kanemoto, and then you chose the Final Gate 2019 title victory against Benkei. And I feel like in two very different ways, you kind of get to see maybe not like his pure genius, but I feel like a lot of what Naruki Doi as a big match wrestler is kind of put on display in these two matches.
Well, I liked watching them back to back because I thought it showed just the growth in Doi's game from 2009 to 2019, where I vastly prefer, in the context of a big singles match, I vastly prefer 2019 Naruki Doi. Now, there's, you know, the 2008 to 2010 World 1 era of Doi is probably my favorite era of his career, but I'm basing that off of largely tag matches and Triangle Gate matches and then, you know, a few singles matches here and there. I'm glad you picked this Kanemoto match because I know that I've seen it, but it has legitimately been 10 years since I've seen this match. It's something that I watched once. I went, oh, Koji Kanemoto versus Doi, that sounds interesting. Watched it, put it in the back of my mind, hadn't thought about it until you sent me the link 2 days ago, and then watched it today and was shocked by the layout of this match and the intensity of this match. And I'm not even sure I particularly liked the match, but I was really impressed by parts of it. And it gave me a lot to think about. But big picture, what are your thoughts here?
So I 16 years ago was actively watching Dragon Gate. I remember when this show finally started floated around. And this, I'll post a Daily Motion link to this show or this match. This falls into kind of that uneasy era of Dragon Gate hasn't uploaded this to the network. For whatever reason, they haven't done this. I know that with some of the Sumo Hall shows, there's parts of it up on the network. This is not, for whatever reason, and knowing how the network works, it might not ever go up there. Revisiting it 16 years later, I think that, is this a better match than the match you chose? Absolutely not. This is a very brutal match. This is actually kind of makes me want to have 2009 Koji Kanemoto go against 2019 Benkei and see what would happen in that kind of thing. Because what I think this match ends up being, and I think I would not have recognized this for what it was in 2009, and then I, being who I am at 20 or 16 years later case, I can now definitively tell you this is an archetype for a match that we have seen a lot more since then. I don't think that this was the first time that this kind of Dreamgate match happened. This would be a fun kind of project to go back and see what this is. But this is, can Naruki Doi survive Koji Kanemoto? Can this young champion survive this match? And it didn't happen in this exact building, but the match it reminded me most of in a lot of ways was Yoshioka versus Ada from 2022 at Ota Ward. Like, it felt like that kind of match. Doi goes through it in this match, and I think that there's no other way to kind of put through it. Kanemoto like immediately gets in control. He does a kick to the head where Doi is on the floor and Koji Kanemoto is just running full steam and kicks him in the head. And then from there, it's a lot of moments of Kanemoto just tearing apart Doi's knee, going for ankle locks in, really having the big counters out of it, whereas Doi is trying to survive and getting absolutely brutalized until he is able to kind of get onto his closing stretch and was able to kind of survive and get through all of it. And really what this match becomes after the survival fact is Naruki Doi, uniquely enough for a Toriumon 2000 project student, never has been a submission specialist, never much of a Yave guy. How is he going to survive against a guy who just completely picks him apart? Well, it takes about like 7 Bakatari sliding kicks and then a muscular bomb to put down Kanemoto. And it's a brutal match. It's not a flowing match. It's not a typical Dreamgate match, but I still do think that when I look at his first Dreamgate run, this probably was the best performance. And I think that's also considering the kind of opponents he had, at least at parts of that Dreamgate run, this was the best match he had against the outsiders that came in for it as well.
It's an interesting match to watch just knowing what we know, which is that ultimately this reign did not work. It's just, it's funny contextualizing it here because I see what they're trying to do. It's so clear, you know, we're going to have these outsiders come in. They're going to bully Doi. Doi's going to defend Dragon Gate, and we're going to be off to the races. And that's what happened in theory. That's not what happened in execution. And watching this match now, I'll say, given what I know just about the native fan base and what they prefer, like, I'm watching this match and I'm liking the match. I'm not loving it, but I'm liking this match enough. And I'm also thinking, well, of course this didn't work. This is like a rugged New Japan main event. You know, this is so much more a Kanemoto match than a Doi match. And a Doi match resembles more of a Shima match than a Kanemoto match. And I think this crowd paid to see more of a Shima match than a Kanemoto match. And it was so surprising to me how long this match was, how violent this match was. At times, I felt like they had great chemistry with one another. At times, I felt like the match was kind of a mess. And it left me going like, no, I think despite not revisiting Doi's Dreamgate run, that first one, in the longest time, I maintain I love the BB Hulk match from November of 2009. I think that's two guys doing some of the best work of their career in such a great era where they meshed perfectly. I love that match. The rest of it, I'm like, yeah, this is not, you know, this is not the Naruki Doi that I came to see. This Doi is missing something in this context. Whereas I think, you know, you go back even 6 months before this match, we're talking about like Summer Adventure Tag League 2008, one of the best matches in the history of the company, and Doi's a large reason for that. But when he left the shadow of Masato Yoshino at this time, I thought it was clear that Doi was missing something. And I watched this match and I go, Doi is clearly missing something.
Yeah, and maybe this is an attempt of, oh, of Kanemoto kick that something into you as an attempt. And I do think that you had this time where Doi's Bravegate run worked out all right. Like, there's never been any discussions about him as a singles wrestler, right? But maybe is it the comfort blanket kind of aspect of knowing, like, oh, I'm the best tag team of the world. I know that I'm with my best tag team partner in the world, and we are just destroying things in 2008 and 2009, and then being thrust into the main event picture, and then having just it was not set up in a way where if Doi ran through Shima and Mochizuki, took out Shingo, and like if he had more of like, if the keys on the belt meant something more going into some of these matches against like Kanemoto, Owasa, and Akebono. Yeah. I feel like that's a major issue that happens in that run, is that this guy is new to this kind of role and the booking isn't helping him much there. I think his performances are pretty good. I think that you have the style mismatch work out in some really good ways out of this. Kanemoto finds like ways to get ankle locks I never thought of during this match, like an avalanche. Doi fives into a really brutal ankle lock, and this is after he gets like another situation where he gets like ankle picked and he splits his chin open partway through. And maybe if it was that kind of match with Mochizuki, there's a little bit more of a connective tissue that the company could get the fan base more behind. But I wonder how much of that failure was not just removing the comfort blanket or the safety blanket, but also not necessarily booking him in the way that really gives you a lot of confidence into him, or really is like providing him with the force of, okay, you leave this title run, it ends up being the longest title run in history up until Shima's Monster Reign, but it just leaves it kind of hollow at the end of it.
Yeah, I think we have the evidence that says that whatever they did not work. Now, it was still fun going back and watching this match, just because, again, I didn't remember anything about it. And so the one spot that really jumped out to me, which is about halfway through the match, is Doi goes for a missile dropkick off the top rope. Kanemoto steps out of the way. Doi takes a flat back and then, you know, shoots back up in a seated position. And when he does that, Kanemoto just kicks him in the head. And that is a spot that somebody should be taking and doing on American television immediately. I love that. I love the timing of it. I thought it looked so good.
Kanemoto's a real jerk.
Yeah, no, good wrestler. Good, complicated legacy, but boy, that guy could work.
Yeah, I feel like the one GWE-ish thing is me going through all of the junior stars work. I feel like
that's a worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah, because how much I really do enjoy Tanaka and Kanemoto and their work together. I'm just like, maybe instead of having Glayton in the background because of my Wookiee life debt to following Strong Hearts people, maybe I just need to do that instead. Case, lay down the pitch for the Final Gate 2019. Doi finally becoming Dreamgate champion 10 years after losing the big one.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about Doi versus Benkei for Final Gate 2019, like you said, and this was a match that I had not revisited since it happened. You know, it was one where I was watching it live in the moment. This is at the time where the English commentary was done by Lenny Leonard and Larry Dallas, which was a fun blast from the past because I thought those two did such an excellent job. You know, I'm perfectly content, not even content, but thrilled with Jay and Ho-Ho as the English commentary team. They are so different than Lenny and Larry that I did think it was interesting going back and listening to Lenny and Larry call this match, because those are two guys, you know, in the sense of Lenny, just a total pro and can call anything and make it interesting. And in the case of Larry, you know, I feel like I've said this 1,000 times over the last 5 or 6 years, say what you will about Larry Dallas, and there was a lot to be said, that guy cared and loved Dragon Gate so much, and he took such pride in doing color commentary for Dragon Gate. And I do feel like on a night like this, we got the best version of Larry Dallas as a person and as a performer. So it was fun going back and listening to that version of the English commentary. But it was also just a match that, you know, in the moment, I think we all thought incredibly highly of. In the moment, we were all shocked by the finish of it. And I just wanted to go back and see, you know, now with the expectation, knowing that it was a great match and knowing the finish, how it was going to hold up. And I thought it held up quite well. It's really, you know, and this is the Naruki Doi podcast, but it's crazy if you have not done it, going back and watching 2019 Benkei, because while I think you and I still think the world of his work, you see that this is like watching an old Nakamura match before the charisma injection, where he's just a completely different wrestler. The way that he moves around the ring and carries himself is completely different than in 2025.
It's very fitting that we kind of have these two title reigns to talk about, because it very much similarly, other than like the in-ring output, had the same air as Naruki Doi's run back in 2009, 2010, let me tell you, Case.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, there's a part of this match that's like the Benkei piece of it that's really interesting. But then as for Doi, again, this is sort of the match that changes the way that we think about his entire career, because going into it, I don't know, it was like a 6 out of 10 on the excitement scale. It wasn't the same as even if we get a Doi singles match now or like a Doi Twin Gate match now. This was like, oh, okay, all right, you know, we'll see what we can do. Well, you know, this will be interesting. It'll be another notch in the belt for Benkei. Surely he'll just move on from this match, and we'll see if Doi can hang. And this match just drastically changes the way that we think about Naruki Doi forever now. And I think part of that, and I'll call my shot here and say that I think one of the single greatest spots in Dragon Gate history happens in this match down the finishing stretch. It's what makes this match go from a great match to truly something special, is when Benkei goes for the spear. And in the same way that sometimes people throw a knee in his face and sometimes they throw an uppercut in his face, Doi hits the Bakatari sliding kick as a counter to the Benkei spear. And they time it perfectly. It looks like Benkei is dead. It's one of the greatest things I've ever seen in a wrestling ring. And I knew that in 2019, and watching it with 2025 eyes, it ages even better. I can't believe how amazing that spot looks.
Yeah, I have down in my notes, I think this is when he started doing the knockout spot. I thought it was always something in hindsight that started after the Shun legit knockout and shoot becomes work. But no, he was doing it that here as well. I just like, The thing that kind of like going into this match, and something that I think is really worth talking about, Doi after the Dreamgate run was seen as an absolute loser in Dreamgate matches. There was a time in 2016 where it felt like that he was right about to win the belt from Yamato. Yamato puts him down in clean order, holds the belt for another 8 months, and or like another 12 months, really. And you had a lot of situations there where it was kind of ingrained that he was going to end up like his run happened, and that was it. And, you know, you could always put him in the Dreamgate equation. He's an easy key to put on someone's belt. And the fact that this match, you have him going to a depths where he unseals the muscular bomb in the finish, really kind of gets like the and Lenny and Larry do a great job of like illustrating it throughout the match, like how it feels like going through the match. Benkei at this point has basically done the thing that didn't happen in Rukidoi in 2009 happened for Benkei, where he beats Pac and then he runs through Yamato, Yoshino, and Mochizuki, the three most valued keys one could have in your defense record, right? Like they really bundled him up with a bow and go like, this is you have credibility, you're going through these kinds of people. So Doi was supposed to be the next person on that list, and instead Doi finds the point where to pick him apart and utilizes Benkei's I would say youthful aggression, but it's just his aggression as his big detriment, and Doi works that around it and is trying to find like the right kind of spot where he's able to go for broke, and he's able to really put him out conclusively with that knockout, and that goes straight to the Doi fives into a long blower, where I thought that was one of his special moves that he also had. And I went peeling through all the various wikis and databases to find out, okay, that's just a Doi fives into a long blower, but that perfectly set him up for the muscular bomb to start his second Dreamgate run. And boy, it really like it's the same wrestler, of course, but like it really shows like a decade of experience and changes in booking and how these two kind of matches kind of accomplish kind of the same thing at the end. But it really feels like instead of 2009, where it's like, oh, can Doi we can't have Doi lose his belt to this outsider, how's he going to survive getting picked apart for 20 minutes? Instead it's like, oh, is Doi going to be the next person in the Benkei? Oh my God, no. But he actually is able to string it all together to get the win. And it felt like it holds up a lot better than I thought watching a match that was like 2 months later, we were in COVID. Like I was wondering, like, is this going to kind of have that feeling while rewatching it? And Doi and Ben got me, because it didn't cross my mind until after Doi had got the belt.
Well said. No, it's an incredible match. Very, very glad I rewatched it. We'll have the link to the English commentary version of it in the show notes, and I would highly recommend going back and rewatching it if you haven't seen it since it happened.
Absolutely so. So let's talk about the NARA show. It was a pretty good house at NARA Centennial Hall. I'll be honest, Case, other than the main event, I thought that this was just kind of an okay show. The main event was pretty special, but it was not there's a reason for the longest time why they didn't necessarily televise homecoming shows, and this show kind of was one of those reasons.
I loved the opening match, and that is, you know, perhaps just another example of Rio Fuda only being able to have good matches with one specific type of wrestler, which is something that I always have my antennas up for. But that opener, before I pass it back to you, was Akihiro Sahara and Rio Fuda versus Benkei and Mochizuki Jr. What do you know? Love and Peace have another great match. And I thought this was really an excellent showcase for all four guys.
Yeah, the one thing I kind of came away from, the chemistry with Fuda and Junior, like we know what it is. Fuda does best with other strikers. The more he works with strikers, the better he looks. The more he wrestles someone who's not necessarily a striker, the more you're kind of going like, what are we doing here? The one thing that maybe stood out a little bit, and I kind of want to push back a little bit, I thought Sahara was not necessarily like his strongest performance, especially when I know he's had better matches against Ben. It just, maybe it could also be like the setup and everything of this. I kind of felt like there was a little lack of snap that he had in other matches. I did enjoy the suplex trade, trying to go for the suplex and then Ben going, nope, I'm doing the jackhammer and finishing this match now. I thought that was a fun finish.
I really like Sahara in this match, and I particularly really enjoyed that finish.
Next up, Kazuma Kimura went up against Masaki Mochizuki. This was not a gut check match. Kazuma Kimura went almost 10 minutes with Masaki Mochizuki. Instead, this kind of went to a match of, oh, Kimura is going to be annoying, and he is not, and Mochizuki at this stage is not able to put him away in the kind of manner that we would expect. Instead, Mochizuki goes for the twister to win after Kimura keeps on rolling through and is trying to go for an armbar. And when he almost gets it, Mochizuki rolls through to an ankle hold, and that goes to that twister. Interesting that this was not the standard veterans versus rookies kind of match, and instead it was kind of a match of its own merits.
I thought it was another impressive outing from Kimura. I really liked their work on the mat specifically. You know, there's the sequence where Mochizuki goes for some hard kicks to Kimura's leg, bounces off the ropes, Kimura hits him with a judo throw, and then just everything on the mat with the cross arm breaker that then gets rolled into an ankle lock counter for Mochizuki. I thought that stuff was really compelling. That continues to be where Kimura shines, and I thought this match was no different.
Yep, this was worth your time. Yamato, Dragon Kid, Sumo Paradox versus Ultimo, Yoshioka, and Monte. That's kind of an odd pairing. And it was a real extended Yoshioka performance where he was in the ring by himself for the first 5 minutes of a match that had the match time here. Went 8 minutes and 40 seconds.
Yeah, no, this is at a point of the show where we can move right along.
Tomonaga wins the entry into the Doi the Doi Proto Show Battle Royal. Only other things of note: this was a match of just doing bits. Doi was in this match and was immediately eliminated. Did this guy need to be on his own show three times? He's not Taiji Ishimori. Like, we don't need that. Just a bunch of bits. Bandito did a slingshot shooting star, which I think is worth noting that he was able to pull off a slingshot shooting star, but Punch Tomonaga won this match and then turned into the promo building up the ladder match at Corkin Hall on Thursday. Lead to the semi-main event, Love and Peace, Hio and Rita versus Daya and Tanaka. Cross Saber on Tanaka or on Rita to get the win. Felt very weird that Jackie Kamei nowhere at all on this show and Tanaka cutting a promo.
He was doing local press.
Oh, he was doing local. Was he up in the Tottori then?
Kame and Horiguchi were in Tottori doing promotional stuff, which is why they weren't in the NARA Rumble. I have that note from somebody.
Okay, because that was kind of a noticeable thing with that. And I knew I saw Tottori coming up on the schedule, so that all lines up. But what'd you think of this semi-main event? The only other, really, the show, the only match that got any time was the semi-main event and the main event on it. So
I thought it was the weakest version of a match that those four could have.
It was kind of nice enough, but it was just kind of samey. I felt like this was like a time where I did distinctly feel like man, I would have rather seen this match of a CEO and Ben versus Daya and Yoshioka. Oh wait, we're not getting that. It was that kind of moment.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
And then we had the main event for Naruki Doi's homecoming, celebrating his 25th anniversary. Naruki Doi teaming with Shun Skywalker and Hamare versus the heel army, Kakuta, Kota Minoura, and Ishin. Doi getting the win after a series of triple teams, ending with a Doi fives, a double kick combo from Shun and Hamare, and then the Bakatari sliding kick on Ishin. Shun is now like the babyface turn has been completely took. Shun Mare teaming with Doi super over in NARA and seen as kind of a thing with Doi teaming with them coming out in a Skywalker mask. This was the best thing on the show, but this had a lot of really fun moments, and especially seeing like Shun really now more embrace that babyface kind of role with Naruki Doi in his hometown.
Well, I thought the dynamic of this match was super fun for everything that you just hit on. You know, now we're starting to see, despite watching this guy's entire career in real time, we're now seeing an element of Shun Skywalker that we've never seen before, which is really entertaining. You know, we're starting to see whatever is going to come of this roster warming up to him and him becoming a full-fledged babyface. It's all going in a direction that I really like. The thing, in a positive way, that continues to jump out to me more than anything is the chemistry between Ishin and Hamare, and I thought they stole the show here.
Yeah, it really, like, it feels like that, like, in the sequence there that like Kamari was floating in air at some points, like before he hits like his wraparound lung blower. It felt like you should not be flying this high, or just in the moment, just the way with this, it is like a level of chemistry. And I think that's gives a level of credit to Ishin and his work really kind of being the base and in these kind of roles, especially as a heavyweight. I mean, he's been the guy that I feel like in the Team Mexico versus Heel Army matches has been the one that I feel like has been the touchstone for Team Mexico to work with. And we got to see it again with Hamari. I thought that that part was really fun, and it just shows like, okay, I'm all right that we're still probably going to be doing Shun Mare versus Heel Army things for the next few months, because there's a lot there to go through, I feel like.
Oh yeah, no, I don't think there's anything to change right now. I would like to see them write out matches like this for quite a while.
And it's just like fun seeing them as like, okay, I'm going to my hometown. Who do I want to have on my team? I want Shun Skywalker and Hamari. Like that is like you hit the nail on the head. It's just like a nice fun moment that we're already getting to see, like, how does this incorporate? So Doi naturally never really aggrieved by Shun Skywalker, other than Shun really just kind of being annoying. So he's right now signing up what's going to happen with like Dai and Yoshioka. That's gonna be real fascinating.
I agree. And I think, you know, to make it easy on this show, I think you got to watch the opener. I think you got to watch the main event. And I think you can wipe your hands of the Nara show after that and spend some time with old Naruki Doi this week. I think that'd be a great way to spend some time.
Yeah, he is one of those like special wrestlers that I feel like coming out of the showcase, the one thing that I think we need to kind of consider with him going on is like he is one of the greats in this company. We're seeing his quarter anniversary mark, and he's still putting on matches of this level. And it's going to be real exciting to see someone like Doi who has this path, like what the remaining years of his career will be, because at least for me, with how everything is lining up with him in this produce show, he's a guy who still has a whole lot left in the tank and at least an interesting enough mind or a good enough Rolodex to put together what seems to be a really fun proto show coming up in a few weeks.
I'm looking forward to that as well. Looking forward to Corkin, which we'll watch this week, and then you'll get your Open the Voice get a day early next week.
Yeah, that's right. We will be expect us either late Monday night or Sunday morning for that. We did our main preview for that last week. Before we end the recording case, run through the card real quick.
Please.
All right. We have opener Mochizuki Jr. versus Kazuma Kimura, match 2, Natural Vibes, Strong Machine J, KZ and UT versus Don Fuji, Takashi, and Monday Ryu, Yamato, BB Hulk, Susumu, and Kagetora of Paradox versus Mochizuki Dojo, Masaki Mochizuki, Ryu Fuda, Daiki Yanagiuchi, and Akihiro Sahara. Match 4, three-way tag team match. It is the Open the Twin Gate champions, Yuki Yoshioka and Dragon Daya, versus Dragon Kid and Naruki Doi versus Shun Skywalker and Hamare. Love and Peace, Benkei, Hyo, and Rita versus Madoka Kakuta, Kota Minoru, and Jason Lee. We're closing out the September 4th Cork, and this is this Thursday with two title matches, Ryoya Tanaka versus Jackie Kamei. And then in the Open, the Triangle Gate Championship, for the first time in Dragon Gate, we have a title match that is a ladder match. Team Mexico making the defense against the Heel Army, Kai, Ishin, Yoshiki, Kato. And it seems like we'll probably have some indications on what Heel Army is coming out of the show on Thursday.
My only preview take for this show is that, and you tell me if you think I'm overreacting, but given the 10 months or so of freak injuries and freak accidents in Dragon Gate, a ladder match makes me way more nervous than it does make me excited.
Yeah, Thursday morning, I'm going to be real tentative, pulling up my phone and I wake up and making sure everything's okay.
I don't know. Look, it could be awesome. I, you know, for as burnt out as I am on ladder matches, this is something that there's only been one other one before. It's on YouTube. It's one of, I think, the most circulated matches in Dragon Gate history because it's always been on YouTube, but it's Genki Horiguchi, Akira Tozawa, and Jack Evans in 2006. And I don't know why they had a three-way ladder match, but they had a three-way ladder match.
It was Wrestle Jam. It was Wrestle Jam.
That doesn't explain the ladder, though.
Wrestle Jam, like they were doing, like they were trying to highlight the connection between Japan, America, and Mexico. And in 2006, Shima thought we needed a ladder match because Wrestle Jam was his idea.
Yeah, so they were like, let's give Jack a ladder. Let's see what he could do there.
Let's give Genki Horiguchi in 2006 Akira Tozawa a ladder. My God.
No kidding. But... you know, that's the only time we've seen anything like this. I don't even have an expectation for it. Like, again, it makes me more nervous than anything just because I don't want anybody on this roster getting hurt right now. So we'll have to see what comes of that. But I am intrigued to see what the layout of that match is. And I'm curious to see what Bendito does specifically.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he pulled off that slingshot shooting star and still had a little bit of clearance when he landed it makes me think we're going to see a masked demon go flying around Cork and Hall on Thursday.
Which is like, I have mixed feelings on, because I was talking to somebody about Bendito earlier today, actually, and they were just checking in just to see my thoughts on what he had done over in Japan. And we were just talking about just him and, you know, how likable of a guy that he is, but how frustrating he is, because when you watch him in the ring with Kame and he's just basing, you're like, oh my God, this guy's incredible. Like, this guy can create highlights off of just basing for people, but then he decides that he wants to be a flyer and the hit rate there is just not what it needs to be. We were talking about the Dangerous Gate match where, you know, he nailed like a really cool step up Swanton bomb, but then also botched an Asai moonsault. And there's just a little bit too much of that when I watch him still. And with this specific match, you know, he's not going to be basing for anybody. He's going to be flying and likely into large groups of people. And I hope it's spectacular, but that, as I determined what this could end up being his last match in Dragon Gate for a very long period of time, I would rather see him against Rita and Jack. I think that's his future, and I think that's his calling card, and I think that's what he does best. But we'll see. Maybe he does something awesome off a ladder, and I'll shut up.
Yeah, no, it'll be real interesting to see how that comes out. And then I really think something big has to change with Kamei coming out of Bravegate on Thursday. I really do.
I don't. I think they're going to beat him, and I think we're all going to move on with our lives.
This is a man who needs to get sent to the other part of the world, been told, no, you're not wearing overalls as wrestling gear anymore. And, you know,
just take the straps down. You wear the overalls, just take the straps down like Yoshino.
I mean, he took them down, then he put them right back up.
I know. It was psychotic behavior. It's literally the weirdest thing he's ever done.
He might be, you know, just from this behavior, like, we have to watch out. Like, let's make sure there's, like, not any, like, disappearances or something. So sometimes I think Kamei has real dark energy, Case.
Well, I'm sure they'll turn him at some point. I don't know if I see it happening at that Corkin show. I think he's just going to get beat, and then they'll beat him again in 6 months.
Yep, nope, that's fair. And as Case said earlier, we'll be back early next week to talk all about it. You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. Case is at _InYourCase on Twitter. I'm at Fujiheya. If you want to step into the conversation, join the Voices of Wrestling Discord. That's where we have the great Dragon Gate channel where everyone is live posting through shows, as well as the Open the Voice Gate channel where we post our show listings. And we have a nice pinned post for all of our historical stuff. You like when we were talking about Doi and his contacts in Dragon Gate history. We have, like, if we can count those days along with the case, we have what, like 60, 70 episodes of historical content available?
I think so. We have a ton of it. You know, there's evergreen stuff all up and down this feed, and there's that spreadsheet there that'll help you find it.
Yeah, and if you're interested in, okay, when does Doi start mattering in Dragon Gate? Well, we did an episode about the Rise of Blood Generation and the Open the Brave Gate Championship Tournament that you can learn all about 2005 Naruku Doi right there. And that's in the Voices of Wrestling Discord. But that's going to do it for us this week. We'll be back with you next week to talk about what comes out after this ladder match in Cork. And take care, everyone. Bye.
Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener. Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself, How many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network.
Hey everybody, my name is Jesse Collings and I am the host of the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, a show right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. On the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, we take a deep look at individual issues and stories that are going on in the wrestling world. Each episode is about a different topic and we take a thorough and educated look at things ranging from current booking trends to breakdowns of individual performers and angles to investigations into different fan cultures across the industry. In addition, we keep a close eye on the wrestling media, and as a professional journalist, I bring a unique perspective to how current issues in wrestling are being covered and discussed through the wrestling media. We have a revolving series of guests from across wrestling punditry joining us on each episode, and we hope that you make the choice to give us a listen on wherever you get your podcast from.